Okay, let's begin. Today, this is our last session of the, we've been here 8 weeks, accomplished a lot. Before we start, because there's a lot I want to do today, let me just make a few comments, pick up on things last time. First, I looked into, incidentally, the copyright issue, and Books in America, they, artistic things, they extended it 20 more years, so anything that was copyrighted, let's say, in 1923 has until 2019, so that answers our question. Also, a number of people are listening to the tapes. You can buy them if you don't get to listen to them, the MP3s, and a number of people have been emailing me, and someone pointed out something that I wasn't exactly correct. Way back when we spoke about Rav Unterman and saving a non-Jew on Shabbos, and I mentioned that he came to YU, and Rav Soloveitchik was very critical, and how Rabbi Riskin sent in a letter to the Jewish Week, which created some controversy. It actually turns out, I didn't note this, that Rabbi Riskin is entirely incorrect. You can see his email, just plug in online, and you can see his letter, I mean, find on the internet. He actually reverses the Rav's view and Rav Unterman's view. So he has Rav Unterman saying that saving non-Jews is because of utilitarian ethics, when, of course, as we know, it was the exact opposite. And finally, Stanley emailed me, and let me just clarify this. Two very good questions. First, let me make clear, and we'll get into this in 1 minute. The issue in Yemen with Rav Kafech, Rav Yechia Kafech, wasn't just Kabbalah, it was also the Shulchan Aruch. They wanted to return to the Rambam's Psakim, but it's not that the Shulchan Aruch has Kabbalistic ideas in it. It does. The Shulchan Aruch is based on Kabbalistic things at times, although he only mentions Kabbalah once. But this is a separate category. You have two categories here. You have the getting rid of the Rambam's Halakha in favor of the Shulchan Aruch, and then you also have the Ari's Kabbalah, and as I said, here's the book. It says, Tmurot Tmurashit Yadu Teiman Tashbat HaShulchan Aruch VeKabbalat HaAri, the Shulchan Aruch and the Ari. And the second question, this is the important one, Stanley asks, is where does this come from? We know that in Europe, the reformers, the Maskilim, they were influenced by their environment. And here in Yemen, you're in the middle of nowhere. You have no influence by outsiders, apparently. And the answer is twofold. There is an element of influence from outside the Yemenite community. There was some Maskilim. There were two in particular, scholars, one by the name of Glazer and another by the name of Halevi, who were in Yemen and came into contact with Rav Yechia Kafech, and they influenced him. In addition, he was being sent books from Europe, and that showed him, that opened up his mind. Even his grandson, Rav Yosef, that we'll speak about today, admits this, that this opened up his mind. It didn't open up his mind in the sense to reject Torah. It opened up his mind to what Torah used to be all about in his perspective in medieval Yemen. And remember, we ended the last class, and we're going to pick up today with Rav Yechia Kafech, his complete rejection of the Zohar and Kabbalah. Now, had he simply said, this is not my approach. My approach is the medieval approach. It's the Rambam approach. But the Kabbalah is also a valid approach in Judaism. It's not my cup of tea, but it's a valid approach in Judaism, which I think is the standard approach of most people today. How many people are interested or involved in Kabbalah? I mean, today, obviously, it's growing with Don and the rest, but the typical Orthodox Jew, certainly the typical Ashkenazi Jew, has no involvement in Kabbalah, but he acknowledges it's an acceptable form of Judaism, an acceptable trend. It's just not the trend that I follow. Had Rav Yechia said that, there wouldn't have been a problem, but he went further, and he declared that it is a complete distortion of Judaism. Some elements of it are even idolatrous, and it must be uprooted. Now, the response to Rav Yechia and his followers was severe, and it caused a great machokas. And as has often been the case in these disputes, the government was even brought into it. The Lubavitchers have a big celebration. When the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, he was put in jail, and then he was let go. He was put in jail because a misnagid informed on him as an opponent of true religion. The same thing happened in Yemen. Rav Yechia was put in jail twice, actually. Not only that, his grandson, after Rav Yechia dies, Rav Yosef Kafech, the law in Yemen was that if you were an orphan, you were raised by a Muslim family. Rav Yosef's two parents were no longer alive, or his father was no longer alive. I don't remember his mother, but he was regarded as an orphan after his grandfather died. His grandfather was raising him. he was removed, and they had to work very hard to get him back. So the government was brought in on this during this great dispute that we don't really have time to go into, although anyone interested, you can email me. I'll send you some links, including articles in English on this. An article just came out last year in an academic journal. It's a journal devoted to the Islam and the Middle East, published the Arabic transcripts, or the Arabic text from the court decisions on this. While this was going on, Rav Yechiya was still a dayan on the Beis Din in Sana'a, but this is not the first time that you have two people sitting on the Beis Din who are totally opposed to each other. We've had that before. The Kabbalist scholars in Yemen, they actually decide to reach out to the great rabbis in the land of Israel, and they were able to get a number of the great rabbis in the land of Israel to author condemnations of Rav Yechiya. They even got some of them to declare he and his followers apikorsim, heretics, because they reject the authority of the Zohar. Rabbi Kafach, Rav Yechiya, responded to these attacks. He basically put those people in Chayrim, or at least the ones that declared him, who put him in Chayrim. And it's a whole literary dispute, and that's really how matters stood until the great Aliyah that began in the late 1940s, early 1950s. You had these two groups, the Kabbalists and the non-Kabbalists, or the anti-Kabbalists. And it didn't bother the followers of Rav Yechiya that these great rabbis in Israel had declared them heretics, because they thought that Rav Yechiya was the Gadol Hador, the leading sage of the generation. And what do they care if some Ashkenazi idolatrous rabbi, you know, in Israel says something? They didn't care. Now, Rav Kook actually writes to Rav Kafach, Rav Yechiya, very respectful letters, trying to get him to change his mind, telling him that you have to understand that although Kabbalah uses all sorts of expressions, they're not to be taken literally. But that did not change Rav Yechiya Kafach's opinion. And the rest of his life, he died in 1932, he remains a fervent opponent of Kabbalah, of Jewish mysticism. I shouldn't say mysticism, Kabbalah, as it developed post-Zohar, because the Rambam could be seen as a mystic. But we'll talk about the form, the Kabbalah that sees the Godhead as not unified, that speaks in terms of Sefirot, and other things, as I'll speak about in a few minutes. Kafach's followers became known as Dardaim. Dardaim, it comes from two things. First of all, it's a contraction of the word Dordaya, the generation, the wise generation. And in fact, on his shul, you can see it written here, the inscription they had on it, where it tells everyone, you know, to be a maskil and enlighten yourself, not haskalah of the European sort, but medieval haskalah, medieval Jewish philosophy. There also was a sage in Tanakh mentioned who's called Darda. So they're the Dardaim. They refer to their opponents as the Ikshim, the perverted ones, the distorted ones, that is, the ones who are led astray by Kabbalah. So the Ikshim never refer to themselves as Ikshim. It's not like in today where orthodoxy, the term orthodox was a term of abuse made up by the Reform, but the Orthodox liked it. Or the term Misnagdim, the opponents, that is, that was made up by the Hasidim, but the Misnagdim, even though the Hasidim were more in opposition to the traditional order, the Hasidim liked the terms. I mean, the Misnagdim liked the terms, so they stuck with it. The Ikshim never took the term, but in the literature, the scholars speak of the Dardaim and the Ikshim. Now, as I said, the controversy remained heated, not just until Rav Yechiya's death in 1932, and really until the Great Aliyah. Since then, the Dardaim have remained a sort of secret society. In fact, many of them, including the current leader, Rav Ratzon Arusi, who was on the chief rabbinate, he's on the Muatzat Rabbanut HaRashit, they really have a different approach. They themselves are not opponents of Kabbalah. Again, that's not how they live their lives. But unlike Rav Yechiya, who's the spiritual leader of the Dardaim, they have a different approach. They see it as a legitimate, Rav Ratzon Arusi sees it as a legitimate trend in Judaism, although, and today they speak it now, there's shalom, there's peace. Rav Uziel actually tried to make peace when after the Great Aliyah began, and they weren't able to come to any sort of agreement. The leadership today sees, no longer feels they need to reject Kabbalah, and not everyone accepts Rav Ratzon Arusi, because you have people who reject it, but that's really the mainstream approach. They've moved away from the unbending opposition to Kabbalah. It's not the first time. Look, the Luther You have plenty of Lutherans today. They don't adopt everything Luther believes. In the Vilna Gaon, to keep it in Judaism, Rav Chaim of Volozhin really retracted the strong opposition to Hasidut. The Vilna Gaon put all the Hasidim in Chayim. Rav Chaim of Volozhin, although he disagreed with them ideologically, he rejected his teacher. That is, he rejected the Vilna Gaon's approach to persecuting the Hasidim. So we have plenty of examples of this throughout history. There was a conference on the Dar Daim a few weeks ago in Jerusalem, and according to the conference, it says that there actually are only a few hundred of them of real Dar Daim left, because I think in Israel today, most people, you know, you're removed from Yemen, you're going to Hesder yeshivas, or you're involved with Ashkenazim and Sephardim, you don't really have the old way of doing things. I did mention in the last class that you have some Ashkenazic Dar Daim, and that's the school of Rabbi Chait, that very interesting school in Far Rockaway, Rabbi Chait's yeshiva. Basically, as I said last week, it's impossible to be an Orthodox Jew today and get rid of Kabbalah. So much of what we do in our rituals, on our various holidays, and in the davening, it comes to Kabbalah. Judaism would be a shadow of itself without the Kabbalistic concepts. Now, if you don't like Kabbalah, you can reinterpret the things you're doing. Take a Lecha Dodi. The whole Lecha Dodi, every line is full of Kabbalistic significance. Reuven Kilman has a whole book on this. But you don't need to read it Kabbalistically. You could still see it as a beautiful prayer and read it more rationalistically. But to get rid of all of Kabbalah Shabbat, to do all these things, it just doesn't work. There's this Haredi in Israel. He's an anti-Kabbalah Haredi, if you can believe this. He even has a book, a long essay against the Zohar. And it's signed, it's anonymous, because in his circles, he'd get in a lot of trouble. He calls himself Rabbi Haredi. And he wants to produce a siddur without any Kabbalah in it. And he emailed me about this, and I said to him, what's the point? First of all, no one's going to buy it. Why are you going to spend time producing a siddur no one's going to buy? But second of all, I said, we can't put the clock backwards. The fact that the Rambam would regard a lot of these Kabbalistic ideas as heretical, especially their notion of a God divided into 10 parts, the fact is that it is now part of traditional Judaism. It might not be your cup of tea, I said to him, but you can't get rid of it. So let's speak about Rav Yosef Kafach, the grandson, who becomes the leader of the Ammonite Jews, at least one circle of them. He's 15 when his grandfather dies. In all of his works, he mentions his grandfather with the greatest respect. And there is no doubt to anyone who reads his writings and anyone who spoke to him, you could speak to him. He was totally upfront in conversations, though he doesn't write about the great dispute in his writings. There is no doubt, though, that he believes everything his grandfather believes, that his Kabbalah is nonsense, although he knows Zohar, he studies it, it's nonsense, it's even perhaps idolatry, parts of it, and that's why he was attacked by other members of the Yemeni community, but he never would write about it, for the simple reason that he didn't want to create machlokas. He refused to even answer a letter I wrote to him 10 years ago about it. In 1943, he emigrates to the land of Israel. There was a lot of Yemenite immigration before 1948, before Operation Magic Carpet. If you want to read about the immigration, which is quite fascinating, you can see in this book, Halech Tamim by his granddaughter. This is a very interesting book. It's not a hagiography. It's not an academic scholarly work of the sort that you can write about Rav Kafach, because it's a granddaughter writing, but it's full of footnotes. She's citing all of the published sources. It's somewhere between a popular scholarly work and a real scholarly work, but it's definitely worth reading. When he comes to Israel, he first works as a silversmith. I'm sure everyone knows that the Ammonites were great gold workers of gold, of jewelry. In fact, the Israel Museum has a whole section with dealing with artwork, not sculpture, but like gold and metalwork. And they would come to Rav Kafach. An article was written about this after he died, the contribution of Rav Kafach to the material culture of Yemen, because they bring him works of silver and gold from hundreds of years ago, and he was the only person who could read the inscriptions, who could tell them about the family, because you had these families for hundreds of years who were silversmiths or goldsmiths, and with his death, all this information is lost forever. I mean, he was the only one who had all this knowledge. And in Yemen, the rabbis worked. They were not supported by the community like they are today. Basically, they worked, and he followed that tradition. He enrolled when he got to Israel. He saved up enough money so he was able to take a year off, and he started studying at the Merkaz HaRav Yeshiva. Now, the Nerkas Rav Yeshiva, this is after the death of Rav Kook, it's headed by Ritzi Yehuda, but the Nazir is there, mysticism is certainly a central feature of that yeshiva, so we see already he's more tolerant than his grandfather. In 1950, he begins to work as a dayan in Jerusalem, and 20 years later, in 1970, he's appointed to the Supreme Rabbinical Court, the highest, the Beit Din HaGadol, the highest rabbinic court. Now, he is as Maimonidean as you can be, but he is taking money for serving as a rabbi, as a dayan. And basically, the Yemenites accepted everything the Rambam said, except for certain things that the practice was before the Rambam came on the scene. They did it, and they didn't accept the Rambam in certain areas. And on this matter, although in practice, most of the rabbis worked there, they never had this opposition to taking money as a theoretical opposition. The Rambam himself mentions that when he writes against taking money for being a rabbi, everyone's going to disagree with me. So Rav Kapach worked as a dayan. Now, the Dardaim in the 1930s and 40s and beginning in the 1920s and 30s, as I said, they were going back to the way things were before the Shulchan Aruch came on the scene in the 1600s and the 1700s, and Rav Kapach continued this path. I mean, by the way, if anyone's interested, you can buy their siddur. I found it online before. There's a website where you can buy the Dardaim's siddur. But Rav Kapach continued paskening only according to the Rambam. Professor Langerman, who's a great Yemenite, a great scholar of Yemenite, I mean, he's from Boston, he's not a Yemenite, but he's a great scholar of the Yemenite tradition, he told me that whenever he would ask a shaila of Rav Kapach, he would be given the answer would only be the Rambam. So when he asked Rav Kapach a shaila, he would only say the Rambam. However, when he was on the Beis Din HaGadol, and you could read his responsa, he would have to cite the Shulchan Aruch, and other things because he's deciding for others. But for his own communities, he only decides like the Rambam. And in fact, I found one area he decides very interestingly, according to the Rambam. It's a good question, taking money for being a dayan versus taking money for teaching Torah. I don't even know if the Rambam would object today to be a rabbi, because the rabbi does so much more today. The rabbi is a social worker, he does all these things. He's saying teaching Torah. So a good question, would the rabbi take money for being a dayan? I know the Rambam sees, isn't being a dayan part of holy work, of teaching Torah, of establishing Torah? The Rambam refused to take any money. He served as a dayan. So it's hard to say. By the way, private money you could take. It's public money. The Rambam himself took from his brother. It's when it's established publicly. So I don't see this distinction between being a dayan or not. It's a good question, though. Rabbi Hirsch says like the Ragachover. I don't know why you say like the Ragachover, Rabbi Hirsch. The Ragachover was the rabbi. He was the rabbi of the Hasidim in Dvinsk. Rabbi Meir Simcha of Dvinsk was the rabbi of the non-Hasidim, and the Chabad, the Lubavitchers, because he was a Chabadnik. He wasn't Lubavitch. He was from a different branch, Rav Zevin's branch. They supported him. They gave him, didn't give him a lot of money, but the Ragachover was supported. If you mean just decided halacha like the Ragachover, you're right. The Ragachover had no interest in, exactly, the Ragachover didn't care about the Shulchan Aruch. He went right back to the Rambam, which made him unusual. Rav Kapach was the same. But I found, here is an example of one of the Rav Kapach's commentaries on the Rambam. He has 23 volumes of this. He was able to complete the entire Mishnah Torah before he died. And in Hilchos Ish Nashim here, I just found this, I was looking through it before, trying to find some nice things to point out, because out of 23 volumes, it's full of goodies. In fact, if you look at the best volumes are the early ones, Sefer Mada and Ava, especially Sefer Mada, where he speaks about the Rambam and his philosophy and science. But in the Halacha, in Hilchos Ishus, chapter 14, the Rambam says that a woman who doesn't want to live with her husband anymore, she simply says that I can't be with him. I despise him. And we force the husband to give her a get. Why? Because she's not like a prisoner that is kept in a prison that some guy can just be in control over her, have sex with her and things like that if she doesn't want to. And Rav Kapach comments on it. How much of the tzedek and yosher and wisdom and tzvuna is there in this psak? And he goes on and establishes that a woman, how can you keep a woman in a situation like that? And he says, if the, the evil Rosh Shachach Me'adorot, if the other sages of the generations and also our generation would see this and would sign on to the Rambam Psak, we'd be a lot better off. And he goes on to say that when a woman comes to Beis Din and she wants to be divorced, the way it is in Israel is they try to make Shalom Bayis. They try to make them, and the Rav Kavach says, absolutely wrong. The Rambam says once the woman wants out, her mind is on another man, she doesn't want to be in this marriage, you keep her in the marriage against her will. Rav Kavach explains, if she doesn't have her mind on another man, she's already with another man. That's not the approach. And I know in America, I asked Rabbi Reese, who's the head of the Beis Din of America, he said that in America they don't have any of this. When you come to get a divorce, they assume you want a divorce and they give you a divorce. But in Israel, they often make it very hard. And the Rambam even says, how do we force the husband? We force the husband by whipping him until he agrees to give the get. And the Rambam asks the obvious question. How can you force someone to give a get? The get has to be given out of free will. And the Rambam says that deep down, every Jew wants to do the right thing. I don't know if that's naive or this is a legal fiction, but he says deep down, every Jew wants to do the right thing. So basically, we're just convincing him of what's in his best interest. It's like when the mafia gives you protection money. We whip him enough until he decides he wants to do the right thing. And that's what he really wants to do, because deep down, every Jew wants to do the right thing. If we adopted this position of the Rambam today, which you can't because you can't have corporal punishment, there'd be no agunos whatsoever in Israel or in the world. Look, in America, we can't do that. So instead, the Satmar send out their goon squad to take the guy to the cemetery at night and let him know what's going to happen. But with the way they do it in Israel, they can put the guy in jail and other things. But if Rav Kavach had his way, there'd be absolutely no agunos, because any woman who wants out, she gets out, and we whip the husband if he doesn't agree. He paskins like the Rambam only when he's paskins to his own community and when he's writing in his sefer here. When he was on the Beis Din, he felt like he had to paskin also using the Shulchan Aruch, because he was paskining for a larger community. However, to his own community, even for Ashkenazim, if you'd ask him a shayla, he'd give you the psak of the Rambam. I'll get into that in a few minutes as well. That's right. Simcha says, until he wants to. That is, you whip him until he really wants to. And he does really want to. He wants to do it because he doesn't want to be whipped anymore. But the fact is, he wants to do it. So the Rambam said, technically, that's good enough. Yes, it's the language in Gittin. So how is Rav Kavach's Maimonideanism seen? First of all, I mentioned in Halacha, but it's seen elsewhere as well. First of all, we see in his opposition to superstition. Take a look at his articles and his commentary to the Rambam. The Rambam in the Hilchos Avodah Zarah speaks against all the superstitions, astrology, and the rest. And you have to see Rav Kavach's comments on there, his biting comments against the superstitions, against astrology. Yes, astrology is found in the Talmud, but as far as Rav Kavach is concerned, following the Rambam, so what? Talmud makes mistakes too. The Talmud makes scientific mistakes. Astrology was considered a science in ancient times. It was considered a science together with astronomy. And therefore, the Talmudic rabbis adopted it. The Talmudic rabbis believed in demons, all these things. And yet, we follow the Rambam, who rejects this. And we're only bound, he says, to Chazal in terms of halacha. If you look, the Rambam followed ancient science, which today we know is incorrect. And Rav Kavach points out there that on all these scientific matters, no, the Rambam, and certainly he's also implying Chazal, they were not following any tradition from Sinai or anything. They were just giving their own opinions. And if you say otherwise, you're disgracing Chazal and the Rambam and the rest, because then people will see that they're wrong and they feel, well, if this is Torah and Torah is wrong, then we can reject all of Torah. The answer is you must distinguish between science and between Torah. But for Rav Kavach, Torah is much broader. He has an article, Secular Studies, in quotes, Secular Studies, in the Rambam, and he shows that what most of us consider secular studies is really Torah studies, science. The Rambam says that the only way to know God is through God's actions, because we can't know God in his essence. So when you study science, when you study astronomy, when you study biology, all these things, you see, you have an understanding of God's actions in the world, and that's how you love God, because according to the Rambam, love of God is knowledge of God. That's what it means, the haftat mal hecha. You can't know God, so you can't love him. It's not a romantic love. It's knowledge. Knowledge is love. So all these things, and that's why the Rambam counts them in the first four chapters of the Mishneh Torah, secular studies are really Torah studies. He's not referring to literature or things like that, although that's also very important because that helps you understand mathematics, all these things. They help you get a better understanding of life, but they're really ancillary, they're auxiliary. But some things, for example, the hard sciences, and perhaps even, I wouldn't say mathematics, it's questionable, I don't know about mathematics, but certainly all the sciences, they are all part of Torah, because they give us a better insight into Maaseh Bereishit, the creation of the world and how the world runs. And for Rav Kossach, it's the greatest tragedy that people who are Talmudic scholars have no understanding or even appreciation of the world in which we live. They don't understand why the sun comes up in the morning and why, you know, how the bloodstream flows and all these things. And Rav Kossach, even when he was in Yemen, would read these works. His grandfather told him. He used to go out into the fields and look at the animals and wanted to understand all these things, because if it's not real Torah, it's ancillary and it's vital. It's a hechsher mitzvah. It helps you understand Torah. So you need to know astronomy. You need to know mathematics. You need to know astronomy to know Kiddush HaChodesh, all these things. So we have to enlarge the definition of what Torah is. In fact, he says it's not just Kodesh, holy, these studies. It's Kodesh Kodashim. It's the Holy of Holies. This is an intellectual Judaism. The way of the Dardaim is not for the masses. It's an elitist Judaism, as the Rambam's Judaism was elitist. Okay, so if math explains all creation, I accept it. My concern about math was, because traditionally you want to know math so you can figure out the calculations in Masachet Kinim and other places, but it's not that the math itself tells you anything, and it helps you with calculations and science, but if math actually in and of itself shows you the beauty of creation, then that would actually be included in the mitzvah, in the study of Torah. The Rambam didn't include math itself. He only includes sciences. The math is something that enables you to better appreciate science. But of course today we know more and more about areas the Rambam had no clues about, and that has to be fit into what he divides Maaseh Bereishit into science and Maaseh Merkava into metaphysics. As I said, it's an intellectual Judaism. It's an elitist Judaism. The masses are, according to Rav Kossach and according to the Rambam, are allowed to continue in their mistaken path. The Rambam says that other than certain basic principles that we have to teach the masses, it's okay if the masses believe false things. If the masses want to believe that angels have a body, or if the masses believe that God has emotions, that's wrong, the Rambam says. He says it in Guide 328, but let the masses believe that. They don't need to know the truth. So there's a real distinction here between the elites and the masses. If the masses start believing that there are two gods or God has a body, well, that's one of the Ikarim. We must teach them differently. But basically, we don't need to enlighten the masses. And Rav Kossach followed this even with Kabbalah. He never saw, unlike his grandfather, who thought that he had to enlighten people, Rav Kossach is more of a Maimonidean. He's following, his grandfather was a reformer. The grandson is a Maimonidean. Those who know the truth, who are in the group, who are enlightened, they're part of the club. If the rest of the people want to continue with their superstitious Judaism, fine. They're good people. They do Torah and mitzvos. We don't need to enlighten everyone. We see Rav Kossach's viewpoint in the introduction to his various works. Let me tell you something else. In his commentary on Nazir, one of the things Rav Kossach did is he edited and translated anew all the Rambam's writings. They did that with all the other great medievals, Bachya and Pakuda, Yehuda Levi. Until he came out with his translation in the 60s, the Rambam's commentary on the Mishnah, you couldn't really study it, because the translation in the back of the Gemara is terrible. He published it, a new translation with his notes. And the Rambam, though, in his commentary to Nazir, chapter 2, he discusses an argument. The Mishnah there has an argument between the Tanna Kamma and Rabbi Yehuda about a position of Beit Shammai. And the Rambam writes, since Rabbi Yehuda's view is concerned with Beit Shammai, and Beit Shammai's opinion is rejected, we're not concerned with his particulars. He tells us that since Rabbi Yehuda is explaining Beit Shammai, and Beit Shammai's view is rejected, we don't need to go into it. Can you think of anything more in opposition to the traditional Lithuanian approach? In the Lithuanian tradition, theoretical knowledge is what's prized most, and it's just as important to understand a rejected view as it is an accepted view. But in the Maimonidean tradition, and if you want to know what the Maimonidean tradition is, you have to look at the Gaonim, and then you have to look at the Rambam, and then you have to look at the Rambam's followers in Egypt and Spain. You can't look at the Lithuanian yeshiva world. That's not the Maimonidean tradition. Yes, they're studying the Rambam, but the Maimonidean tradition is a tradition that focuses on practical halakha. And therefore, you don't spend your time, you don't waste your time, the Rambam says, studying Svarot of Beit Shammai just to understand them, because that's not what it's all about. The Rambam himself writes in one of his letters that the desired goal of the Talmud has been lost. That is, the desired goal is to get to a practical halakha. Today, the Rambam explains, people study the Talmud as if the purpose of it is arguments. And that's what makes the Talmud great, is the arguments. The Rambam says the arguments there by accident, because we don't have the proper answer, either because we lost the tradition or we can't come to a proper conclusion. But in the best of all worlds, there wouldn't be any arguments. But, of course, in the Lithuanian world, the arguments become central. And that's the essence. The Rambam says the arguments are unfortunate, and we have to deal with them. In another letter, which applies to everyone except for the most advanced students, the Rambam says that you should only devote yourself to the Mishnah Torah and the Rif. Only if there's a disagreement between the Mishnah Torah and the Rif do you then look at the Talmud. Only super advanced scholars study Talmuds, and then they could use the Talmud to paskin shailos if something's not clear in the Rambam or the Rif. But the average person only studies Rambam and Rif, and there were communities that only did this. That is, there would be no Daf Yomi, according to the Rambam. Daf Yomi would be you study the Mishnah Torah and the Rif. And if it's something you don't understand, you want some clarification, you go to the Gemara. And as I said, in Spain, there are places that only study the Rif and the Rambam. What's the point in just studying Talmud? After all, if it's about practical halakha, today we would say you study the Shulchan Aruch, maybe. You don't study, the average person does not study Talmud for its own sake. This is the exact opposite of how Rav Soloveitchik explains in Halachic Man, the purpose of learning. He says, learning to know the halacha, that's what the practical doctor does. However, the higher level is the theoretical, the physician, the one who studies about diseases, or the one who's devoted to research. He says, the one who's involved in practical halacha, he has to lower himself, and the Halachic Man wants to be involved in theoretical learning. Not the Rambam, though! Rav Kapik was the first one in our time, the first one in hundreds of years, to explain the Rambam in accordance with the Rambam. That is, you see a halacha in the Rambam, you must look at what the Rambam says in his responsa. You must look at what he says in the Parish of Mishnah and the Sefer Mitzvot and his letters and compare everything. No one did that until Rav Kapik. Nachum Rabinovich, in his multi-volume commentary on the Rambam, Yad Peshutta, he is following in this tradition. You have to look at the Gaonim. You have to see what tradition the Rambam is following in. You have to look at the Rif. And Rav Kapik has the advantage, because he grew up speaking Arabic. This is his language, his first language. It's intuitive knowledge. You can go to the university and become an expert in Arabic, like Professor Blau or Shailat or others, and translate the Rambam, but you don't have that same intuitive understanding. It's like someone else who learns English. They'll speak it fluently, but they won't have the same appreciation for the nuances that we do, especially a language which has been dead for so long. Judeo-Arabic of the Rambam was not spoken, except that they knew it because they were brought up with it, studying. They studied the Rambam in Yemen, the 4-year-olds and the 5-year-olds and the 6-year-olds, from the original Arabic. And there was a tradition in Yemen for almost 1,000 years about how to read these texts. And Rav Kapik often quotes, this is the tradition, this is what we know. We have this from the elders of Yemen. For Rav Kapik, Judaism, therefore, is a religion of intellect. And since it's a religion of intellect, great focus must be on theology. In the traditional Ashkenazic world, you don't study theology. It's pushed aside. It's not a concern. But for the traditions of the intellectual approach, the Dar Daim, you must study. Because the theology is, as the Catholics call it, the queen of the sciences. You must study theology. And that explains why Rav Kapik translated Rav Bachya ibn Pakuda, Rav Sadia Gaon, Rav Yehuda Levi, all the great Judeo-Arabic texts, he translated them into Hebrew. So people today could study them, because those are our great works of theology. But as I said, like the Rambam, he wasn't trying to bring this to the entire world. He even writes in an esoteric fashion. The Rambam, as I'm sure many of you know, writes esoterically. He hints to things. He has hidden teachings. Rav Kaffach also has an esoteric way of writing. He hints to things. He says, I can't explain more on this. Dov Schwartz has written an article about this. I found areas where Rav Kaffach hints to matters. Because he's writing to a community of intellectuals. Those who understand him, fine. Those who don't understand them, they too can live a good life. Not a problem. Let me give you a couple examples. Well, just a few things of even before we get to that, where we know his opinion, but he didn't want to publicly speak out against it. Hakafot. In Israel, it's very popular today. Hakafot Shniot. This began in World War II. They do a second Hakafot. And Rav Kaffach was very opposed to it, this idea they bring the Sefer Torah. You're not supposed to bring it out of shul. It's not respectful. He wouldn't speak publicly about it because it's such a big thing today in Israel. But he told his followers he won't publicly disagree with the Chazon Ish or with the Maharitz, the great Yemenite authority, because he doesn't want to create machlokas. But he tells his followers. He was very concerned. He didn't want to create machlokas. Why does he need to go tell everyone the Chazon Ish is wrong? You know, he's devoted to his followers. He'll tell it in his shul, where he gave shiurim almost every night. And he would write about it. In one essay, he writes about going to cemeteries. What do people do when they go to cemeteries? They recite Tehillim there, they daven there, and yet the Rambam says, you don't go to cemeteries. And the Briskers won't go to cemeteries. The Rav writes how until his wife died, he never went to cemeteries, and only after his wife died, he couldn't help it. Now, what's the problem? Well, as I said, why do people go to cemeteries there? Well, it's one thing if you want to have an emotional connection to your relative. That's understandable. But next time you're in a cemetery, you see people reciting Tehillim, right? You see people davening. Completely forbidden, according to the Rambam. Completely forbidden, according to Rav Kaffach. It's a form of superstition. It's akin to idolatry. It's Doresh HaMeitim. What do you do there? Why are people reciting Tehillim or prayers? They're asking the dead to intervene on their behalf. They think that they can connect to the dead by reciting Tehillim. They think that their prayers in the cemetery, because the dead person's there, God will connect to them better or something like that. This is all superstitious, Rav Kaffach says. We must keep away from this. And if you're using the dead person as an intermediary, you're really coming into the area close to a Vodah Zarah. And the Rambam himself says, in the cemetery, you could speak about the dead person. You can't learn Torah. You can't do anything. What's the point of cemeteries? It distracts us. We understand it. It's popular religion. It even has an emotional pull on everyone. For Rav Kaffach says, you must get out from this emotional pull. That's popular religion. That's superstition. That could even become a form of idolatry because you think the dead person is going to intervene upstairs for you and you're praying there because you think there's some sort of holiness in the cemetery. Rav Kaffach says the cemetery is tummy. There's tumah there. There's no holiness there. So we must remove ourselves from popular religion. He writes about this. I mean, his whole essay on this. So in this way, but he's not telling everyone. He's not going out and telling everyone to be like this. He's telling his followers, you want to be a Dardai. You want to follow the Rambam. You want to follow the tradition, the intellectual tradition. This is what you need to know. In his commentary on Hilchot Mikvaos, on the Mishnah Mikvaos, the Rambam comments there that one who is Tovel twice is Maguna. That is, you tovel yourself because you're tummy, you're impure twice, it's foolish, it's distasteful. What do you tovel yourself twice for? You do once is enough. And Rav Kaffach comments there that this is unlike those people, he says, you speak of people we have today, who tovel themselves many times, and they think they're the reincarnation of Naaman. If you remember Naaman in the Bible, who had to tovel himself because he had leprosy, this is such a sharp comment against the Mekubalim. They think they tovel themselves, and that's a big thing. You know, the Rav never went to the mikvah before Yom Kippur. What's the point? The Rambam never mentions it. It's a mystical thing, and it's a very nice thing, I'm sure. But from a Kaffach's perspective, you go to the mikvah if you're tummy. If you're a kohen, or you need to touch a dead animal, if you're a woman, you don't go to a mikvah. What does a mikvah have to do with anything? If you want to get close to God, you take out a Mishnah Torah and study it. Or you take out a Tanakh and study it. These are ceremonies, to use a term the Rav used to use. They're ceremonia. And Judaism, according to Rav Kaffach, doesn't know ceremonies. We know belief. We know our beliefs. We know our halacha. This is a ceremony that you bring in some new concept. You go tovel yourself in a mikvah. Rav Kaffach says we don't have ceremonies. We don't have ceremonies at cemeteries and in mikvahs and things like that. We have halacha. And we connect to God through philosophy and things of that nature. We don't do actions that people just, now we have all sorts of things. We have palm readers. We have various segulot. They give you, you repeat this verse a few times. We have people who see the future. We have people who do all these things. Remember what I read last class about the Harry Potter, when these magicians see me coming, they run away because your father's a Dardai. All these things are phony. They take advantage of the simple people. And they created a magic. They created magic, and Judaism is not about magic. But Rav Kavach understands that simple people need the magic. Rav Kavach wrote a book on Jewish life in Yemen, and he has chapters there about the superstitions in Yemen, and he describes them. It's a very important book. It's the only book about traditional religious life in Yemen. So Yemen had so many superstitions and so much crazy stuff going on there, how to protect yourself from the evil eye, if a woman is going to give birth, all these things. Rav Kavach, as a good scholar, describes it all. And yet it's all nonsense in his mind. It's all superstition. It's all pure Judaism has been sullied by contact with the Arab peoples and with Christianity and all these phony things, Greek civilization, which is not part of authentic Judaism. Rav Kavach, most people don't notice this, but if you pay attention, you see it. He'll never use the expression, Zechuto Yagen Aleinu. Often you will refer to a great rabbi. Sometimes you say Zatzal, Zecher Salat Bracha. Other times you say Zion Yud Ayin, which means his merit will protect us. That means up in heaven, his merit, like the Talmud describes with Rachel or something, but his merit, because he was a great tzaddik on earth, he can go to God and plead to God that the Jewish people, on my merit, all the mitzvot I do, God, watch over the Jewish people. And that's a very common idea, But from the Maimonidean perspective, it makes no sense at all. The dead people, once they die, their spirits are connected to God. They don't have any connections to what goes on earth. They're not watching. They have no knowledge of what's on earth. It's just a superstition. So what does Rav Kavach in his writings say? Zechut. What does he say here? Zechut limut Torah to yagen aleinu. That is the merit of learning their Torah. That is, you take the Chazon Ish, or Moshe Feinstein, or Olah Tzurevi, it's the merit that we have upon learning their Torah, their writings, that then protects us, and that gives us a good life, and that puts us in a good place in our relationship to God. Not the Chutoya, not the Olah Tzurevi, or Chazon Ish, somehow that he, after he's left this world, has some sort of involvement with this world. No. It's superstition. It's a removal of true Judaism. However, Rav Kavach never explains this. He never explains anywhere why he says Zechut Limud Torah To. But if you know Rav Kavach's writings, you understand what he's getting at, you see what he's talking about. That precisely because the dead have no connection to us on earth. In fact, Rav Kavach elsewhere points out, and this he writes, in criticizing the people who pray to the dead and things pray for the dead and all that, he says there's a contradiction here. On the one hand, you pray for the dead. Pray that their neshama will have, as the expression says in Shul, someone gets an aliyah, gives them money, everyone says, we pray that the neshama will have an aliyah. We did something. We gave tzedakah, and therefore the soul in heaven will be raised up. Rav Kavach says, well, if you believe that the soul in heaven needs us to do things to raise it up, then what sense does it make to say that, then to go to the cemetery and pray, hoping that the dead person is then going to benefit us? Which is it? Does the dead person need us, or do we need him? The answer is, the two have nothing to do with one another. On this earth, we relate to God. We don't have any intermediaries. We don't think about the dead. The dead is, we think about them when, in a sense, what they gave us spiritually. But we no longer have any connection to them religiously. They've moved on to their eternal reward. And any connection to them, any praying to them, any belief they're going to come to you in dreams, all these things, that's just taking your mind away from where it should be. It should be on the here and now. You're so busy thinking about the dead and what they think and this and what's going to be in the afterlife. Our job is the here and now. And everything else is a distraction of true Judaism. And if you get back to the Rambam, what the Rambam taught us, you could see all this. It's amazing for Rav Kavach that everything you need to know was told to us 1,000 years ago. All you have to do is go back and read the Rambam and Rasad Yagon and Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and Rav Bachya, and of course sometimes they disagree with the Rambam, so the Rambam is the authority, he overrides all of them, but they're all important because they teach an intellectual Judaism, not a Judaism of the mind. It's an elitist Judaism. It can never be a Judaism for most people, and it doesn't appeal to the masses, but this is for those who can handle it, as the Rav Kafach might say, this is the only Judaism. It doesn't say the Kaddish. The idea of a mourner's Kaddish is a medieval thing. It talks about something else, if I'm not mistaken, will help the dead. We have plenty of examples. I mean, we have the halachas about going to a cemetery, so the dead will come to you and things like that. All these things, the Rav Kafach follows the Rambam. You interpret them a couple ways. Either they're not meant to be taken literally, or they either not meant to be taken literally because the rabbi who said it was mistaken, that's what the Rambam says in his letter on astrology, or it has a hidden meaning. It's not to be taken literally. If the masses want to take it literally, they can take it literally. Those are the two things. The third one is that the sage didn't really believe it, but he thought it was important for the masses of the time to think so. That's what the Meiri says about Zugot. The Meiri, although the Rambam doesn't say this, the Meiri sees himself as a follower of the Rambam. You have this notion about pairs, that if you do things in pairs, it's dangerous. That's why the Gemara has to say that Pesach night, how can we have four cups? It's a special Eil Shimurim. It's a special God watches over us. The Meiri said that Chazal knew that it was a superstition, this idea of pairs, but the people were so attached to it. So what Chazal did was that they channeled this attachment into a positive thing. Instead of being worried about dualism or pagan superstition, you put it into something connected to God. But you have plenty of midrashim. The Gemara speaks all about demons. So sometimes you could say these are examples where the sages were mistaken, or other times demons is simply the way they expressed matters, but not to be taken literally. Look, that's why the Rambam was subject to such dispute. Because in the Rambam's tradition, Chazal, when they're not speaking halachically, are not binding authorities. The Rambam says this explicitly when it comes to science, and he says this at many places in the guide when it comes to ideas. The Rambam says, Chazal say this, but we reject that. Not all the theological beliefs of Chazal are accepted, because in the Rambam's opinion, Chazal disagree with each other. And therefore, he's following one Chazal tradition, and the other Chazal tradition is the rejected one. The most famous example of this is the Rambam says that why Shiloh HaKein, why do we send away the mother bird? And the Rambam says because we're merciful. And yet the Gemara says anyone who says that we send away the mother bird because of mercy, it's a mistake. We do it because God commanded us. And the Rambam says, well, we reject Chazal in this, that there's another opinion he found in the Midrash. So the Rambam and Rav Kafach exercise great freedom in they don't see themselves as rejecting Chazal per se, but there's more than one tradition in Chazal, and they are following the Maimonidean, the intellectual tradition. And incidentally, if you look at the Yerushalmi, you don't have so much talk about demons and things of that nature. He has a whole essay. It's only a couple pages, but it's an essay about putting the Ezrat Hashem on top of your letters. You know, people put Ezrat Hashem, it's a popular thing, God should, with God's help. We say all the time, Emir Tzah Hashem, but in letters, the Ezrat Hashem. So Rav Kafach says, it makes no sense. What's going on here? First of all, he says that in Yemen, they never did this. They never put that on top of letters. And he now wants to explain why they didn't. Incidentally, in his tshuva, he quotes the Rugged Shover. The Rugged Shover says he shouldn't. But he says, if the practice is only a couple of hundred years old, now if the content of your letter is holy things, positive things, well then God has nothing to do with it. You have free will. And if you're writing about bad things, you're saying lashon hara and all that, then certainly God has nothing to do with it because God doesn't know anything improper. So he's not saying you shouldn't write Bezrat Hashem. He's explaining why the sages of Yemen, the philosophic tradition, they never wrote Bezrat Hashem. Because in the world of free will, we do it, we're on our own. Now you could say Bezrat Hashem means God gives us the ability to write the letter, you know, not that God has anything to do with the letter per se, but Rav Kafach is simply telling you that we have free will. And he's explaining that this philosophy, this idea that we do things on our own, not everything is controlled by God, that there's an element of free will here, that this explains even such a small thing why the sages of Yemen would not write the Ezrat Hashem on their letters. For him, the truth was the guide and not authorities. And as I said, you can see the four volumes of the yearbook, Masor El Yosef. His followers have put out four volumes. Every year or two, they come out with another volume in which they interpret the Torah and the Rambam, etc., in line with Rav Kafach's approach, using his writings, but also his general approach. And, I mean, the message behind it, all of this is that truth is not settled by majorities. In fact, in his commentary to the Morne Vilchim, he published the Morne Vilchim with the Perush in Guide 215, the Rambam says, truth does not depend on how many people agree with it. If it's true, it's true. And therefore, if you've proven something scientifically or philosophically, you don't need to cite authorities. And what does Rav Kafach say after that? He says the people today, and he said the poskim today, should bear this in mind because they feel they need to cite lots of sources. And that's what poskim do. They're always citing sources, some more than others. Rav Moshe Feinstein wasn't like that. Then Rav Kafach is saying you don't need to be like this. If you prove to your satisfaction this is what the Rambam means, that's all you need. If you are convinced that this is what the philosophical truth is, you don't then need to go find sources, find an achron, find someone else to give you cover. Everyone tries to do this. And Rabbi Slifkin, and those who read his stuff, he always has to find one rabbi says this, another rabbi says that, to try to give himself cover, I guess, so he's not attacked. For Rav Kafach, you don't need cover. Truth has its own importance. Truth is the cover you need. You don't need anything else. And that is the approach of the Rambam. That is the approach of Rav Kafach. One of his students, Rav Aaron Kafach, no relation to him, he's published two volumes which deal with Rav Kafach's commentaries and in his volume, Minchat Aaron, page 438, for those who want to check, he reports he once asked Rav Kafach what Minhag Yerushalayim is. What's the custom? What's the practice in Jerusalem? And Rav Kafach replied to him, there's no such thing as Minhag Yerushalayim. There's no such thing as the custom of Jerusalem. There's only the Gemara and the Rambam. That is what the Gemara and the Rambam says, that's what you do. There's no minhag of a place. Again, totally against everything we understand to be, that there's a minhag of a makom, and you do things differently depending on what the practice is. But no. There's the Gemara and there's the Rambam. And if the minhag Yerushalayim is a mistaken minhag, then we don't follow that. And if it's a correct minhag, then we follow it. But not because it's the minhag Yerushalayim, it's because that's what the Rambam says. It's not an easy form of Judaism. It's easier to go along with what everyone else does. Yet, as Rav Kafach often pointed out, this is not the way to be a follower of the Rambam. The Rambam was always by himself. The Rambam had to fight opposition. The masses are never going to have the truth. So you're going to say you're going to go along with everyone? The masses are always going to be mistaken. In fact, you can find this in the Shulchan Aruch. I think it's the Taz who cites this expression. He's referring to Pesach. He says, das balabatim, the opinions of the masses is always mistaken. He's referring to an halacha. That if the masses tell you what the halacha is, it's mistaken. But from the philosophical tradition, from the Kafach tradition, it's not just halacha. It's everything. If the masses have a conception of God, of truth, of notions of free will, all the important issues, you know it's mistaken. So you can make the choice. You're either going to live with the masses and live with mistaken views, or you're going to live with the elites, with true views. The struggle is, and this was the Rambam's own struggle, it's Rav Kafach's struggle, it's the struggle of the Dardai, is to live in your mind with the Rambam, but with your body, live with everyone else. Because we cannot be. Rav Yosef understood this. His granddaughter writes, speaks about it also. We're living in a world of non-Dardaim. So therefore, we can't be telling everyone that the Zohar is idolatrous and that Kabbalah is destroying Judaism. You need to live with people. So you need to live as communities of intellectuals, he says, his approach is, where, and this is the Rambam's approach, you live as an intellectual, but you live among people who have different views, but as long as you share these views among like-minded intellectuals, like-minded Dardaim, and you go to your Dardai rabbi, you keep the proper opinions, but you don't need to indoctrinate anyone else. You recognize that their approach is, you're tolerant of it, and you live your approach. Of course, you know in your mind, just as they know, but you know that you're following the real tradition, the tradition of the Rambam, the intellectual tradition. But it's not an easy tradition. It's And in fact, if Tzvi Langerman is to, if Yosef Toby, another one of the great students of Rav Kafach, is to be believed, towards the end of his life, Rav Kafach began to tilt even more to Rav Yehuda Halevi. Rav Yehuda Halevi's not so intellectual as the Rambam, a little bit more element on the emotionalism, and but in any event, this is the way of the Dardai. It's not an easy approach, but it's an approach which puts you have to skip over hundreds and hundreds of years, which is why it isn't successful today, because you can't, how can you skip over hundreds and hundreds of years and go back to the great medievals? Judaism is a continuous religion, but it's out there, and Rav Kafach, as a member of the Beis Din of Jerusalem for so many years, as one who was a spiritual leader, not just of Yemenites, the entire religious Zionist world, he became one of the great postgame for the religious Zionist world, he stands out as one of the most outstanding figures. The Rambam had to reject majority opinion because the majority disagreed with the Rambam. And the Rambam knew the majority disagreed with him. Truth, he says, does not depend on majorities. Truths are eternal. The Rambam did not believe, and Rav Kafach didn't believe. You can't tell Rav Kafach, well, that today the Gedolim have decided differently. They've decided that your view is mistaken. Truth is eternal. It doesn't depend upon what the rabbis say. The rabbis have to follow the truth. The truth doesn't follow the rabbis. So you can't decide matters of truth as halachic decisions. If the Rambam said it, then it's always valid, if because it's truth. You wonder what Berger would say. Well, Berger would say, I think, that Chabad has crossed the line and it's real idolatry. But the Dardaim believe some of this is real idolatry also. I don't know, I asked one of Rabbi Chait's followers, because apparently Rabbi Chait thinks some of this Kabbalistic stuff is real idolatry. And I said, well, he doesn't go about and try to convince people otherwise. And he says, what can you do? You can't help it. Everyone's following it. I mean, so you're going to say, well, what about it? Can a person be a witness at a wedding, etc.? I think the attitude is that you do the best you can in this world we're living in. And as I said, most people don't really believe this. Most people are simple Torah Jews. They accept Kabbalah as part of the Jewish tradition, and they venerate Kabbalists, and they venerate Kabbalah, but they don't really know what it's about, and they're not involved with it, and you can't really say they're true believers. Now, with Chabad, Berger has not followed the path of Rav Kafach, and he's not followed the path of all the other Gedolim. All the Gedolim, that's why he calls his book The Scandal of Orthodox Indifference, all the Gedolim have basically decided that there is a mistaken approach and we should try to convince them otherwise, but they are not out of the fold. And that is Rav Kafach's opinion also, and David Berger ends up looking like Yechia Kafach, a voice shouting in the night that no one's paying attention, and Rav Yosef Kafach recognizes that people could have totally mistaken views. Like, let's think about Chabad for a minute. According to the Rambam and Rav Kafach, if you believe that God has emotions, basically your view of God is completely distorted also. It's just as bad as believing the Rebbe is a Messiah. However, we don't need to change their opinions because this is not an Ikar Amuna. So I think you'd say the same thing. Achrei Rabim Lahatot. What does Achrei Rabim Lahatot mean? It has so many understandings of it. Basically, it only means go after the majority. Even Poskim point out it only means when a group of Poskim based are together, sitting together. You know how many Achronim have said that it doesn't apply? It doesn't apply except if you're in a Sanhedrin. That it only applies if we are together with all the Rabbanim, because they say even though the majority disagree with me, if they would hear my arguments, they would end up agreeing with me. So this is a big machlokas. People like Rav Avadia and others believe that Achrei Rabim applies even in Pesach. People like Rav Moshe Feinstein don't believe that. They believe that a poseg looks at the material and comes to his own decision. And certainly, when it comes to matters of truth and philosophy, the Rambam says there's no such thing as Achrei Rabim. And it makes perfect sense, because halacha is a system of behavior. At the end of the day, whether we poskin this way or that way, we're not making any claims that we have objective truth. That's the whole lesson of the oven of Achnai. The halacha maybe could be different, but on this world we have to make decisions. And that's why Zaken Mamre can continue teaching his opinion, but not lemaisa, not in practice, but in theory. But when you're dealing with issues of eternal truth, there's no distinction here. You can't say, well, Achrei Rabim Lahatot, the truth is the truth. And in halacha, the truth is the truth. But in practice, we go Achrei Rabin Lahato. We never say that the truth of halacha is Achrei Rabin, only the practice is Achrei Rabin Lahato. So it's different. You're saying according to Rambam it's based on majority and Yiftach Gedoro v'Shmodoro. Those two things incidentally are contradictory, majority and Yiftach Gedoro. The Rambam's halacha basically is he's following what the Gemara decides, or what he feels the Gemara decides. In the Rambam's day, the Rambam knew, and he says many times, the majority of Gaonim disagree with the Rambam, but he doesn't feel bound by them. Only in the Talmud. He's bound by the Talmud. So I'm not sure what you mean when you say that he feels bound by the majority. He feels bound by the decisions of the Talmud and the Mishnah. But he doesn't feel bound by the sages in his generation. He doesn't even feel bound by the sages prior to him, the Gaonim. He feels that after the Talmud's concluded, it's every man for themselves. No, the Rambam's son was not a Mekubal. The Rambam's son was a mystic. Incidentally, the Rambam could be a mystic. But you could be a mystic, but not be a Kabbalist. For example, look at the end of the guide, 354, where he speaks about how you can walk through a battlefield and you're so connected to God that nothing happens to you. I mean, this is love of God. The Rambam's son broke with his father in certain areas. He became a mystic. That is, what is mysticism? This personal connection to God, you know, not just intellectual, but the personal spiritual, where God comes into your soul. I mean, that sort of thing. Mysticism has hundreds of definitions, but that's not Kabbalah. He doesn't know the Zohar. He's not reading the Ari, anything. It's Sufism. His son, Rav Avraham, was very much influenced by the Sufi mystics. Although Rabbi Labaton of the Syrian community in Deal, he's finishing his PhD in Rav Avraham ben Arambam, and he wants to argue that the influence of the Sufis on the Rambam on the Rambam's son is overrated. But yes, the Rambam's son diverges from the Rambam in that. But again, he's not a Mekubal. He's a mystic. Kabbalah is specific to a certain tradition. Begins in Spain and then moves to the Ari. You had mysticism going back to Talmudic days, but it's a different thing. I'm not sure I understand the difference here. Berger speaks about the scandal of his indifference. And I think that's the biggest proof that they don't agree with him. That when you say, he thinks indifference means if anything other than putting these people on chayrim, you're indifferent. They're not indifferent. They think it's wrong, the Chabad and all this. But they don't think it rises to the level of excommunicating them, just like many of these Haredi rabbis don't think being a Zionist rises to the level of excommunicating us. So we should be thankful for that. And some of them think it's kafira, also Zionism. So before we end here, and again, I just want to thank everyone. Now, let me point out one or two more things. It's really been a great semester. Those who want to contribute, $10, $20, there's a little donations. I know they'd appreciate it. This is free. I do want to point out just something, because in Purim spirit, I opened up Rav Goren's, his volume of Tshuvot. Just give you one final thing before we end from Rav Goren. He was asked to Shaila, and if you look through it, you see that he was even being asked Shaila's after he left the chief rabbinate in the late 80s and early 90s, although he had no real following, he was still being asked questions. And one of the questions was, can you have a Purim rabbi? It was a tradition in yeshivas to crown someone, the Rosh Yeshiva, for Purim. And basically, they lightheadedly, they made fun of the rabbi or the Rosh Yeshiva in a lightheaded way, in a gentle way. He was supposed to be gentle. And this has become very out of style in today's day and age. It's taught not to be respectful. Rav Avadi has a tshuva saying it's absolutely forbidden to do a Purim Rav. And Rav Goren says, no. He says, this is part of our tradition, doing a Purim Rav. And it actually shows you the difference between real rabbis and Purim rabbis. You know who a real rabbi is and who a Purim rabbi is. Unfortunately, throughout the year, many of your rabbis are Purim rabbis. I guess maybe that's the underlying point he's making. So I think that's very interesting. In any event, if anyone has any more questions, I'll stay in a few more minutes. I think it's been very enlightening. I learned a lot from the questions and the emails, comments. I know many people are buying the MP3s because at least they're emailing me. So I think we're going to pick up again after Pesach and have to pick some new figures. So I hope for the newcomers here, it was enjoyable. Rabbi, any comments on my comments?
Yeah, I just want to thank you. As you noticed, I came in late today. They were coming from a meeting, but I just want to thank you again for your most interesting and enlightening classes, and for all your efforts. And it's most enjoyable, and I think it's a great learning experience. And people are buying the MP3, so I want to thank you. And you've really been on from the beginning of E-Team. And we look forward to learning with you, you know, as we move forward. We're work on the schedule. I'm just letting everybody know I haven't sent an email. Probably in the next day or two, we're going to have a pre-Pesach program about, you know, 15 Yoshirim or so. Okay, I'll let everybody know about that. And we'll continue. This particular class will continue. We don't know exactly the day. We'll let you know. We're working on it for this year and for next year. And thank you very much. And I will echo, I didn't ask, you know, Mark to say it, but it's, if anybody would like to make a donation, if I can say so, they are greatly appreciated. As you know, we do offer this for free, and as you can well imagine, it's not free to run. I know a number of you have donated. We greatly appreciate it. And if anybody...
Okay, we lost you in the last minute there.
Yeah, okay, I'm back. I know that happens occasionally. Anyways, Yasher Koach, and to everybody, if I don't see you before, Chakasher B'Sameach, and I think I've spoken long enough. Thanks. Have a good night.
And now let me just say one more thing. Those who only came on this time, all the previous classes, they're on MP3s. There's mistakes on two of the Rav Kook tapes. There's a gap. They should be giving out for free. I think they're going to set that up. But you have our whole series on Rav Herzog and the Satmar Rebbe and Rabbi Chaya Kablammer and all that. And really, it flows. So to get a sense of how we're going, a number of people have been here from the beginning. So if you want to get a sense, Rav Kavach was a very big Zionist and a very big lover of Israel. And he became one of the great post-scheme for the religious Zionists. In general, all the Sephardim, as we mentioned with our talks on Rav Avadia and Rav Uziel, they all were Zionists. He didn't have anti-Zionism in the Sephardic world, but he was a great lover of the State of Israel, and as all the Yemenites were. Okay, everyone, this is very good. I look forward again to seeing you. Have a good Pesach, everyone. We'll pick up after the Chag, God willing.
Okay, Lila Tov, good night, everybody. Thank you.